Blog Talk Radio.
The sun go down and lulls us to our sleep. Beloved who makes the earth so round about the sun to sweep. Mother who speaks her words in the silent moonlit night above.
Saturday morning, and this is Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. You are on the air with Paula Thompson. I'm Paula Thompson, your host, and with me is my dear and good friend, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre. How you doing?
Pretty well. How are you doing, Paula?
Good. Always so great to hear your voice.
Likewise.
We have a great show today, I think. We have a very good friend on. A 38-plus year reader of the Urantia book and sincere, avid student of the Revelation, who has been on an incredible spiritual journey in many ways. And Robin Liskey, and I have been friends for many years, and we've shared experiences together and collaborated on projects and compared notes, and both of us have sincerely tried to share the Revelation in our in the very best ways we could imagine possible, and Andre has too, I know. And you know, it's a daunting experience, it's a daunting task, because if you haven't read the Urantia book, it just so you know, it has a way of throttling you and taking you over. and so you really have to try to find ways to share it with people, because it's just so inspirational, so powerful, so amazing. I wish there was a word good enough for it. If I could dream one up, I would. But Rosie, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you on and hear from God's art department.
Yeah, the art department. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
How many hours have we spent chewing up the phone lines about these subjects?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And my Urantia family can always call me Rosie. That's just how it's going to be. Yeah.
Is that
wonderful?
Yeah.
Well, I know you've written three books now, and because I know you so well, I know how many years that you ruminated about these works, and since the early 90s, maybe even before that, you were working on Eve's Tarot.
Right.
You're an extraordinary artist. You have a history in art. And maybe tell us a little bit, and we'll get into your books and what they're about and that they're published and they're doing well. But tell us a little history about your spiritual journey and how you ended up in the art department and what your particular expertise in art is and your inspiration.
Okay. Well, art itself is something that I could never really successfully get away from. And it's kind of like, you know you're in a really good marriage when you can't break up with a person. And the Urantia book is much the same way. You know, it comes into your life. It kind of ruins your life in a way because it's such a big, odd duck of a book, and you go around trying to tell people about it, and they think you're well and truly out of your gourd. And for me, I always try and get away from things that make me feel challenged and uncomfortable. So both art and the Urantia book, and at times my marriage, have all kind of fallen into the same category. But being a parent, wanting to run away from your kids. But for me, the UB came into my life when I was in a time of spiritual crisis in my early 20s. And I was seeking and seeking and seeking through so many Eastern religions, and, you know, I had pretty much abandoned traditional Western religion. And then I was unsatisfied with what I was finding there, so I was reading just tons of physics, which has always kind of been a happy place for me. I love to study physics. And some of those guys, like Max Planck and Einstein and Newton, have wonderful, fascinating things to say about spirit. They just do. And so I felt I was more on the right track, but I still wasn't finding information that I felt was really God-worthy when it came to a concept of God himself. And so one day I put out a prayer, and I said, you know, I really want to believe in you, but I can't find good information. I can't find information that is intelligent enough. And if you're out there, would you please send it to me? And it was not 3 weeks later that I ran into the Urantia book. And at the time, the thing that was interesting was at the time, I had been taking out loads of books from the library. So there were stacks of books everywhere in my house. And so I saw this book, and it was on a coffee table. And it had an aura about it. It literally had a field of living energy around it, unlike all the other books that were in my life at that point. And the first thing I said was, oh, my God. I said it to my friend. Oh, my God, how interesting, a living book, because I'd never seen one. And I started to thumb through it, and I had no idea what to make of it. It was so confusing, and it was so big and dense, and the authorship was really strange. And, you know, at first I thought, is this a joke? And so I went to his house, and I checked it out probably 4 or 5 times. And, you know, like a lot of people, when you're first looking at the book, it's like, oh, look at these strange names and look at these strange things they're talking about, and how could this thing be real? But I thought, if I'm really going to investigate, then I'm really going to check this thing out before I just reject it because of its complexity and its size. Mm-hmm. And I asked him if I could take it home, and I took the book home for about 3 weeks. And intermittently read it, and I kept coming across information that was so crystal clear. And even though I didn't understand the conceptual vocabulary of the book, it called to my heart. It was so clear. It was so beautiful and so profound. And I made a decision at that point to actually study it. And I was very young. I was only 23. And with all the, you know, ego of youth, I thought, well, I'm going to master this material. I'm going to learn it. I'm going to master this. And, you know, 38 years later, I'm still trying to integrate this. There are times in my life when, you know, I've tried to leave the material, just leave it, because it's so challenging, And I can't. You know, I'll go off and I'll read Carl Jung, and you know, right now I'm steeped in a lot of back to physics because I just love physics, and but I can't leave this information alone. I have to come back to it. I have to integrate what I'm learning with it because it has so imprinted how I think about God and the universe. It just has. So.
Well, and it's so relevant.
Wow, an artist who loves physics, huh?
Yeah, I'm an artist that loves physics. Yeah, I am. Yeah. Both sides of the brain firing, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
And,
good job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How I ended up in the Urantia Art Department.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Perfect.
Right.
Yeah. How old were you when this all happened? Were you about 20?
I was about 23. Yeah,
23,
23
okay.
was the really formative, you know, it was back in the hippie era and...
Sure.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
Were you with your husband, yeah. Bill, at that point? Or was that before Bill?
I met Bill in that same... The Urantia book and my husband came into my life in the same year, each devastatingly complicated.
So just so you
yeah.
all know, to our listeners, Rosie married a remarkable person, and he's an awful lot like her. I mean, you guys are both so similar. You're both artists. You're both keenly intellectual, very intense. And so what a great marriage you've had. You really support each other and stimulate each other. And I've always been inspired by your relationship and the things you've told me about it. So... And they have two sons, and they're both artists. And, and
yeah.
so it's, you're really like you have your own little art colony, which is, you know, awesome. I know Bill plays,
He plays the saxophone. He composes music. He's a sculptor. He turns wood. We're trying very, very hard to create a community here, a creative community that's larger
yeah.
than us. And trying to bring in individuals who we feel are really good quality people, not just good quality artists, but who understand what it is to have community. And it's not really about spiritual community, but it's definitely about ethical and moral and artistic community, for sure.
Well, and that's really where the creative imagination comes in, and we know, and I'd love to hear you expound a little bit on the creative imagination, because that's kind of where, in my mind, where you live. And, you know, I know you bought a house in Prescott, Arizona, and you have a beautiful studio there, and you really love the way that, because you've lived in Phoenix for a long time, but you love the way things have gone since you moved to Prescott. And,
oh, yeah.
And your
it's
studio
perfect.
And... Yeah, and the art, you actually are in several galleries, right? Or you're very involved with artists in the area. I know.
Really involved. Well, I'm in shows. I haven't really been, frankly, I've been focused a lot more on the internet and on working on setting up a store online. And when I was in London, my site got hacked, which my son said is the downside of popularity. He said, Mom, this is just the downside of popularity. So we're having to redo that whole thing. But I do have an online store. I'm in shows locally. But really, since my focus is much more on getting to bigger places, you know, mm-hmm. I'm more interested in getting my work into San Francisco, into London. I'm very drawn to London. And I don't know if New York is going to figure into it, but I want to plant these things where the angels can use them, mm-hmm. you know, and because they kind of have to, I think when we're working with concepts that are revelatory in nature, and this is across the board, you know, for listeners that read the Urantia book or people who are drawing from other information that is revelatory to them. As artists and writers and dramatists, we need to place these more enlightened and progressive concepts where they can be found in bigger venues.
Right.
Because I think that the angels can just work a lot more effectively if we're sensitive to these places that are gateways into the world.
Right.
And, yeah, so that's really what I want to do.
Well, so let's...
That's what I want to do.
Yeah, and that's what you are doing, you know.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your three books, and then we'll get into the one that you're working on right now and the reason you're studying physics, because you want to write one on angels. And I know that a lot of your art has angels in it, and, you know, you think about the angels, you work with the angels. You also have a really amazing relationship with Jesus Christ, and you always inspire me that way. But tell us a little bit about your three books, Eve's Tarot, An Idiot's Tale, and your children's book that you just launched, which was a delight for me to discover. The Children's Calendar of Dreams. Wow, it's so beautifully illustrated.
Thank you.
Just amazing illustrations.
Thank you.
That was
a project that I did really as when I was very close to childhood, and it's just all these dreams and fantasies about the seasons. And that book is for children. The other two are really fables that are more for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I picked the subject matter is because after, you know, years of study in the Urantia book, and being an artist and writer and wanting to share the things that I've learned from it, I really thought and prayed a lot about what are the most important things, what's the most important and immediate information that can be shared? And why should we, you know, what should we share? And Spirit, God, was very, very clear in answering that prayer for me. And for me, I feel the assignment is to share how the angels are working with us. Because they're just out of our range of vision. The Urantia book says that they will become our best friends. You know, that in all the ages and eons to come, through all the worlds of progression, that they will become our closest friends. And so it may help us to think of them as being our closest friends now. And to muse on how they work may help us to become more sensitive to how they're actually working. And so the subject of the angels is really, really important. The next subject I feel very, very drawn to share and get into is the Master's Essential Gospel, which is the gospel of worship and service. And you and I have talked about it so many times, about how this essential gospel got buried in original Christianity, ended up sort of, it just kind of got buried in there somewhere. The beauty of its simplicity, the accessibility of it in experience, and how radically it alters how we relate to one another when we are thinking of going within and loving God and worshiping God and then going into full throttle, full-hearted service with our brothers. It is a dynamic thing. It changes everything. And the Urantia book tells us clearly that if we embrace this simple approach, that it would completely alter our planet. They say that the gospel of the Master has never yet been tried in 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that I felt is key and important information and will be the subject of a book coming up that is going to be called The Master's Way. And then the last thing that I feel very, very drawn to write about and do art about are the seven absolutes. And the way that the seven absolutes are described is the Father, the way that we perceive him and experience, the way that he is reaching us in the realm of experience. And a lot of people who get into the UB and study the UB feel that this information is very dense and inaccessible. But I feel that we can present these concepts in ways that make it accessible and make it understandable. And so I'm going to be doing a book called The Hook of Heaven that's going to be about the Seven Absolutes. So,
wow.
So those are the subjects that I feel really, really pulled to cover in it'll be over a range of projects, over a seven-book range of projects. But the books that I have in place now, the two books, and you know just how long I worked on them, on Yves Thoreau, The Story of Adam and Eve, is an important one because we look around our planet, many of us, and feel there's something desperately wrong, and we don't know what it is. You know, it's like, what happened? We just feel that things are in a bigger mess than they should be. And the story of Adam and Eve in the Urantia book is so fascinating, and it's probably one of the oddest tales in the book, actually, the story of a kind of extraterrestrial Adam and Eve. But as it sits with you over time, it's interesting to me. As it sat with me over time, it inspired art and inspired a deep-level desire to connect with that story and connect with it as a mother. And so the reason I think that Yves Thoreau took me so many years to write is that in the Urantia book, the way they describe Eve, they describe her basically as a well-meaning mother who failed in her mission. And that is a universal experience for us as women. We know what it is to be well-meaning mothers who fail in our missions with our children. And I think for me, that story had to unfold in my own experience in order for me to be able to write about it. I had to go through it. Yeah. So that Yves Thoreau is very much about the story of Adam and Eve in the Urantia book. It's about spiritual decision-making, what it is to be a mother who has her heart absolutely in the best place and fail and experiences dire failure. And that's what that book is about. And it came about because I kept thinking of these images of these kind of weird tarot cards. And so I'm a printmaker, and I was doing these images, and I thought, geez, this is so weird because these look like tarot cards that Eve would have pulled. And so the images appeared long before the story did. And the story just has had to unfold through time. So that's
well, and you
that
write,
book.
You write the story, too, from a perspective of, I'm trying to think what, as I read it, what I get. I get, like, maybe someone who is very close to Eve, maybe attending her, like one of her children even, or perhaps an assistant, or someone who's there and observes her closely. And,
she's a human witness. She is a human witness to this, who is very, very close to Mother Eve.
So she shares her observations from a point of view of, I don't really know what's going on with her, but I see her, and I feel her anxiety. I feel her, you know, her deep longing. You know, so it's such a sincere, really story from that point of view, from a human point of view of what this amazing being, Eve, might be going through at this time as she mulls over the many challenges that she faces on this world. And, you know, in a way, the story from the Urantia book is so splendid. It's so beautiful in that it really gives us the daunting challenge they faced. And I've often thought, you know, coming from where they came, even though they were, you know, they came from a place that was so beautiful and perfect compared to this world, I think that made their task here even harder.
Because, yeah. And I think that's, you know, if you look at, if you look at the experience of spiritual masters who come to this world and how many times they end up really in deep level trouble, you know,
yeah.
they come from
Jesus.
A place where they're, look at what happened to Jesus. They're trying. They come from a place of divinity and perfection, and this is a recurring theme in my stories, and because it fascinates me that the divine seeks the human and actually becomes more divine by going through these horrible human experiences, which are common to us. These experiences are common to us, and in Yusuro, that is one thing that I wanted to communicate, was that they started from this lofty place of near perfection, and come into becoming human, being degraded into the human state, which is in a way a more holy state. You know, because the angels seek it. The, you know, Jesus sought it. God seeks it. God seeks experience through us, which is common and difficult and rife with stupidity. In order to gain, as a divine being, a greater range of experience. And And it's fascinating to see and muse about that process.
You know, I have to say, I have to just jump in here and say that, Rosie, people women and men have a lot to learn from you in how not to be saccharine. My goodness, those are unvarnished words when you tell us. You know, We really mess up. And when you say Eve was a well-meaning mother who failed in her mission, and it occurs to me that, you know, we all know that that's her immediate mission, you know, the one that she was here doing 37,000 years ago, been rehabilitated and is certainly working hard now. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you've dovetailed that with your own realizations in your own life. I mean, is there anything that you'd like to share in terms of how your own life might have paralleled something that came to this kind of poignant realization? Because it's really deep. I think it's that poignancy and its relevance and the fact that it's out of your own experience makes it something that maybe a lot of women and a lot of men could relate to.
I remember being a young person and feeling that I had attained sainthood. No, that it was like, oh, well, you know, if only I could have the universe pipe into my consciousness, we would all immediately be elevated Godward, and none of this stuff would even have to play out. And then you go through your life, and for me, I went through my life as a mother and just radically failed. It wasn't like I just kind of sort of failed. And I would come out of some episode of radical failure and feel like, well, that's okay. That was just that. This next time will be a lot better. Next time I'm really going to, now I'll do this one really right. And then radically fail all over again. And so it's been, for me, it is really and truly about that. But I wrote, I don't know, I had this experience in England. It was really interesting where I met somebody who was very successful. I mean, they were, oh my God, they were doing art and selling it for millions and just this artist life that you think that you would want, that you would think would reflect real success. And the guy just was so clueless about and so disinterested in my experience that I thought, you know, all this failure, I'm going to read something to you guys that I wrote.
Okay.
Hang on just a sec.
Good.
Hang on, I've got to find it.
Sure, no problem.
Blue. Here it is. That I thought all this human failure, what is it? The experience depressed me horribly. And I didn't know what to make of it, and I went back to the hotel room and was horribly depressed by how I'd been treated by this snooty, snooty man.
Oh.
And you know, who was very, very successful in my world. And so then I was laying in bed, and I thought, all of a sudden I felt such gratitude for every horrible, rotten experience of failure that had ever laid me low. So I wrote out this prayer of thanks, and it's called On Beholding a Successful Man. I said, thanks for the poverty that has kept me from any attempt at a first impression. Thanks for the hesitation that kept my hand from being too firm. Thanks for the children that have swarmed at my feet, chaining me to the earth, their arms reaching, entwined with my success, bringing illusion to ruin, and delicate moments where I might climb out of plainness, out of my earth, to some heaven of bright, cold achievement, all tumbling down in a humble pile of laundry and lost toys. Thanks for the indignity of sweat and empty accounts, for blank looks, where appreciation may have doomed me to dismiss the lady, waddling to the corner with her bags as being unworthy of her story.
Oh.
Thanks for the lost years that have aged me before my time, so ancient gods can have their moment of creation at my expense. Thanks for my dismal resume and all I can't explain or when, and every cheap thing that's been lost at such a dear price. These things have been the cost of my humanity, the reckoning of where my feet have pounded out their unheard rhythm and earned their thin but significant coating of dust.
Wow.
Oh, Rosie. Yeah.
Very, very beautiful.
Yeah.
You slay me. I needed to hear that one today. Thank you.
Did you?
Thank you
for yeah.
That. Yeah, I did. I really did. Yeah, you know, that someone on the board said, you know, it's unfair to put the whole onus of everything that came down because of the Lucifer rebellion onto Eve. And I really agree, and I know you do too. We
yeah.
As mothers, I look at her with so much heart and so much feeling. And many times I've said to her, you know, if only you had talked that all over with Adam. You know, that
yeah.
whole plan, that whole
yes,
scheme.
Yes, that whole
and
scheme. Right.
And then I think,
yeah.
but, you know, but being a mother, you know, and feeling so responsible all the time, you really wanted to do something. And they tell us that it was her impatience that, you know, they boil it down to that one thing. It was her impatience. She really wanted to make a difference. So even though, you know, she failed, she failed because she cared so much about
yeah,
us.
You kind of have to wonder, in a way, how that ended up playing out in their relationship over the next 40,000 years.
Yeah.
We think we have, you know, moments in marriage where it's, if you had, you know, look what you did, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
look
yeah.
what you did. Yeah. You know,
if only.
Well, her story is, you know, it's like we look at this planet and we know that actually our planet was so challenged before they made their appearance, which was one of the things that tripped her up. Because for people who, basically they came from planet New York to planet Alabama. That's what happened. And they didn't have the resources that she needed, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Or the, you know, and however much counsel she was getting, it wasn't resonating. And... Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
her story is our story. We are in a family. We're in a
yeah.
family. So she is still our mother, and she's still weighing in. And it's just like God in human experience, that we all are having to go through this as a family, aren't we? To figure this one out. Yeah, what mom did. To figure out what mom did.
Well, yeah, and you
which
know,
is
it
what our
so
kids
much...
have. To, it's what our kids have right. to do. It's like, mom.
Yeah, huh. we do, and we look at our own parents that way and their human frailty. And one thing that it shows me more than anything is that, you know, to lighten up some of my expectations about what I can reasonably accomplish in this life and what other human parents can do. Because if a perfect parent who came from a perfect sphere and was imported to this planet found it to be very challenging and difficult, why should it be any less for me?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for real. Yeah, absolutely true.
I like to tell people becoming a mother exploded all my myths about motherhood. And I'm sure that for Eve and Adam and even for Christ Michael, becoming a human or living on this planet exploded any myth about living on a material world, you know,
it's
the
just
reality.
You wonder what, you know, we know, well, and that's something about angels, too. We know that God and spirit longs to connect with us because we do represent the greatest distance, really, from divinity. We represent the densest material form, the most innocent and blank mindset that is available, and the longest reach Godward. And so God in experience longs to reach down into this level, and because it's through that that they can experience. That is the totality of experience itself.
Right.
And I love what the Urantia book says about how God longs to break from the fetters of infinity and the bonds of perfection. And when I think of it that way, then I think, look how much work he actually did to create this whole level of consciousness that is as dense as ours, so that he can tunnel through it and get this range of experience. And lately I'm looking at my body wrinkling and crinkling, and I've been like, you know, God, what were you thinking? What was this? And getting back in prayer, it's like, well, I want to experience what it is to feel ancient. You know, where I am, I know I'm ancient. I know that I'm unending. I've been around forever. But I want to really feel it. I want to feel what it is to be a crinkly pod, you know, and an ancient grandfather, grandmother. And
right.
All you can do is like, thank you, God.
Yeah, thank
all
you
right.
for letting me
thanks.
Feel that with you.
Thanks, God.
You notice as your body becomes, you know, I like to say gravity is in the process of taking back that which belongs to it, right? So
these
material elements belong to the gravity of this world. They belong to this world, and the world is taking them back. But the spiritual elements belong to God, and so he's lifting those up. And there's an interesting distinction of, you know, gravity taking back the body, but God lifting the spirit. So there's a heaviness of material, but there's a lightness of being that comes with wisdom and age. It's just absolutely priceless. I mean,
exactly.
It's a wonderful experience.
Do you guys, I don't know if how you feel during this interview, if it's okay if I read some stuff that I'm writing or working on. Is it okay?
Absolutely.
I wrote this. All right. This is going to be from the Working Angels Companion. And these are, the Working Angels Companion is this, it's going to be like a 1940s style magazine, a pretend magazine that is by angels, for angels, and about angels. And so it's written from the perspective of the angels. And I just wrote a little story that is exactly what we're talking about. And this angel writes, I'm reporting from Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I'm on death watch with my compliment for our human subject, Daniel. Daniel's been stricken with kidney disease for the last 6 years. He's held fast to his physical body and rigidly followed medical help, feeling increasingly desperate to hold on so that he and his wife can arrange for her care once he's gone. We've been coordinating their efforts with the help of other angels working locally in an insurance facility to attract human attention to their file, which was misplaced in a pile on the wrong desk. We almost succeeded this morning with a coffee spill, but it was cleaned up too quickly, and they still failed to notice the misplaced spill nearby. Sometimes human efficiency, coupled with a lack of attention to detail, is the bane of our existence. We're planning on misplacing the assistant's keys tomorrow so her eyes might fall on their file. We were instructed by the spirit within him to be vigilant as his body has begun to move into the early stages of failure, and this afternoon a thought came into his mind that had to do with light seeping from the edges of a door. We were instructed to enlarge this thought and allow him to see his relationship to his body as it really was. So we were to expand his vision, as he pushed himself up from the sofa, he saw light beaming from the heavy wrinkles in his armpits and from beneath the bluish webs of lines on his hands. He blinked furiously, afraid his eyes were going bad, but as he arose, he saw the imprint his behind left on the cloth of the couch also flooded with light. He tried to turn quickly, swollen with edema, to call to his wife, but with his senses deranged, was unsure where to find his voice. Panicked, he padded across the room on his bare feet to find her, only to see the same light filling each footprint he'd left on the carpet. Hang on just a sec. His human mind couldn't make no sense of what he saw, but it suddenly struck him as funny. This seeping pod that could no longer contain him. He felt peace at that, and we were instructed to remove his enlarged vision and allow his senses to come back to normal. Tonight, Daniel is feeling peace for the first time since the onset of his illness, and the sense that he and his wife will be able to face his coming departure. He told her to think of him every time she sees light seeping out from the edges of a door. We're almost certain we'll be instructed to help her forget to turn off the lights of rooms with doors in the near future. An angel of health and his compliment on Death Watch in Nova Scotia.
Wow.
Wow. So that...
You're really getting into the mind and experience of an angel.
Trying. You know, it's like, how do they work? We know that they work in our environment and we know from experience all the times when things that we have forgotten or, you know, a misplaced set of keys will lead us to something that's very, very important. Or it's just so, you know, I'm really musing a lot on how they're working. But it's that subject of the body being filled with light, you know, and breaking open like a pod, just like what you were talking about, sis, brought it to mind.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, and how we can only benefit in every way from trying to get into their mindset and what they perceive and how they work and understand, because our understanding of angels has been so lacking. I mean, you know, oftentimes we've thought of them as just messengers and they float around without really much to do. But clearly that's not the case. They do so much. They are vital. They are on every level of creation. They are the hands-on group.
They really kind of function the way I've thought of angels is they really do function as mothers do. They take their origin in the mother spirit. They do represent compassion and love in action. And they're very, very busy, just like mothers are, dealing with the environment that surrounds us. And we know from the Urantia book that they have to go through eons of training before they're assigned a human being, and how competitive they are for those assignments.
Yeah.
You know, how there'll be like dozens of angels wanting to work with one of us. One of us!
Just
and so it's like, what do? They must do a tremendous amount in our environment. And the ways that I'm probably portraying it are not accurate and not right, but it's the best my human imagination can do, you know, to try and reach into a muse about how these beings are working with us.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that kind of imagination is remarkable, you know, that not everybody's able to do that, for one thing, and it gives us sort of, it forces us to change our perspective and take another view as to how this might look from somebody else. And even if a person might quibble about details, like keys or whatever, you know.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah.
You know, like how do they really do it? Well, you know, to me, that's all plausible. I think they do whatever they can, you know, to get our attention.
We know that they work through it. We know that they, the Urantia book says, it's not about your whimsy or your wishes or any of that stuff. They take their orders from God in terms of what we need and how we might need it. You know, but I think their mathematical ability, in the UB they talk so much about the angels having this prodigious mathematical ability. They must be interacting with levels of energy in so many different ways, and in ways that are really incomprehensible to us, because we're not innately mathematical, most of us. And UB says, anything that you do to attempt to understand angels will benefit you. It's a good place to go for us.
Well, you know, and since you said that, I have to read that quote because I have it all queued up. I went and found it. It's from Paper 38, Ministering Spirits of the Local Universe. It says this about angels. It says, angels do not have material bodies, but they are definite and discrete beings. They are of spirit nature and origin. Though invisible to mortals, they perceive you as you are in the flesh without the aid of transformers or translators. They intellectually understand the mode of mortal life, and they share all of man's non-sensuous emotions and sentiments. They appreciate and greatly enjoy your efforts in music, art, and real humor. They are fully cognizant of your mortal struggles and spiritual difficulties. They love human beings, and only good can result from your efforts to understand and love them.
Yeah.
Only good can come
only
from that effort to
come from it. Right.
Right.
And I, you know, as an artist, and as somebody who's loved, I've loved angels my whole life. Since I don't know what your experience was with angelic presence when you were a kid. You probably had vivid ones, but I just had such vivid experiences when I was a child with angels, and I fell head over heels in love with them.
Me too.
And I just fell head over heels in love with them, and those impressions have never gone away. And so as an artist, you know, naturally in my life I've always sought images of angels and been repeatedly frustrated to see them only portrayed in passive poses. They're benevolent and beautiful poses many times, but they're also passive. And you know, if you're sensitive to angelic energy or an angel lover, you know that the last thing that these beings are is passive. They're not.
Right.
They're not sitting around.
No.
At all.
No, they're not. they're working. And, you know, again, I have to draw on, you know, you say they come from the spirit and the spirit's attitude. There's another quote in the book that always comes to me, and that is very simply, the spirit never drives, only leads. Mm-hmm. And so I really like your story that you shared with us from your book Coming Up. From the angel's point of view, they're trying to lead us to certain things that will lead us to certain other things. They're not driving us. And there's another point that the Urantia book makes throughout the entire book, and that is that God and all of his loyal agencies will never seek to coerce us into any decision. They want us to decide of our own free will. The angels, it also says the angels won't coerce us or try to force us to decide something, but once we do decide something, in other words, the way I understand it is once we make a consecrated decision, they will help us make the most of that decision. And that's the potentials inherent in that decision, because every decision we ever make has consequences. So they'll help us make the most and get the most good and value out of those potentials from the decisions we make.
And they're relying also. They are literally, I always conceive of angels as literally being drawn like moths to the flame, to the father fragment within us. They come from the mother spirit. We contain within us the seed of the father. And that is the seed of ideas, of ideation, of original thought. And so they're... relationship is one of being very, very nurturing and supportive of what we conceive, you know. And so that's a very symbiotic and natural relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I just want to say...
Go ahead,
well,
Andrew.
No, I just want to station identify that you're listening to The Cosmic Citizen. We're interviewing R.E. Liske, Rosie Liske, on art, inspiration, and angel awareness. And it's so wonderful to have you here. Go ahead, Paula.
Well, I, you know, your experience with angels as a child, it reminds me of what I experienced. And I always felt them. I was keenly aware of their presence, not because of anything overt they ever did, like appear to me, for instance, or, you know, see ticker tapes in my mind or anything like that. I've heard other people have had those experiences, and I don't deny them. I never deny anybody's spiritual experiences. They reach out for the unseen. But I keenly felt their presence, and I keenly felt that they were privy to my, to me, and to what was going on with me, even as a child. And I was connected to their heart. I feel their heart, which is interesting for me. I feel what they feel, and a couple of times I believe that I've actually cried with them. And in that quote that it says they feel all of our non-sensuous emotions. I feel that sometimes they grieve for humanity, and they grieve for the sorrow that, you know, we create down here inadvertently. You know, I don't think we lose our way, and we stumble into some of these traps.
Well, and they say in the Yubi, they say they literally weep for our willful intolerance. And, you know, these ways that we just get so dug in and unforgiving and unbending. And me, the angel thing, I never have seen an angel. I've told them very clearly, I don't want to see angels. I mean, no offense. I love angels, but I would just crap my pants if I ever saw an angel, or I would think that I'd need to go on medicine, because my head is weird enough. It's not like I need to start seeing people showing up and talking to me. It's like, no, we don't need those experiences. But the way, in my experience, when I was a little girl, it was before I could really talk very well. I was just so I could see them in the eye of spirit. And I felt their beauty, and I could feel when they were playing with, they play with children. And and I could feel them playing with me. And I had one experience, and this is an odd experience that stayed with me for all of my life. But I used to, when I was a little tiny girl, feel Jesus really close. But he was like working in an office. But the office door was open, like it was ajar. You know, but I could see the light from his office in my little child's mind. Mm-hmm. And one time I felt that the angels weren't playing with me, and they were a younger set of angels. And they were like teenager angels, which means that they may have been a seraphim and cherubim type combination instead. And they were talking among themselves, but they weren't playing with me. And I was, you know, I just noticed it and just felt mildly irritated. It wasn't that upsetting. But the master, in my child's experience, came out of his office and said, I told you to play with her. I told you to watch over her and play with her. And then they did. And it was such a vivid experience that it stayed with me all the rest of my life. And, you know, I don't know. I think children are, you know, before churches get a hold of them, or, you know, before they get dug into some psychology around God, the veil is just thinner. The veil is way thinner. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You know, Andre, you may be delighted to know that Rosie and I share an experience as children that we both at one point admitted to somebody in our young lives that we wanted to become a nun.
Yes, exactly.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Rosie
had
a Jewish grandmother, and so, you know. And I remember my own experience. I told my mother because I heard that nuns got to marry Jesus. This is why I wanted to be a nun. Because I've been madly in love with Jesus all my life. I can't remember a time when I didn't feel his presence keenly and just love him so much and want to know everything about him, everything I could find out about him. I was so hungry to know all about him. And I told my mom I wanted to be a nun, and she just laughed and said, you can't be a nun. You have to be a Catholic. And I was crestfallen.
Me too. Oh, well, my mom came from a long line of Lutheran ministers, but she hated Catholicism because her mother was a Catholic who was like banging her over the head with it, and so my mom was horrified when I came to her and said I wanted to be a nun, and I said, Mom, I want to be a nun, and I said, what does nun mean? And she said, it means none of this and none of that.
Well, that would be true in many quarters,
You can't be a nun, you're a Lutheran. And it was like, no, I'm a Lutheran. I was devastated.
Oh, this can't be
so funny.
It's so funny.
It's funny
I'm right
how
there
that
with
involves.
You, sisters. Yeah, because until I was 14, I wanted to be a priest. So,
did you?
There
you
go.
That's one of the things I wanted to be. So,
well, probably a lot of us that end up in this kind of work. I don't know. In my family, there was such a long line of, on mom's side, of military and ministry people. They were either in the military or they were reverends, and some of them were really kind of kick-ass reverends. and so I think when we end up in this kind of work, there's probably a good reason. For it, we probably have people in our past who've been, you know, spiritually driven too.
Oh, I'm sure of it. I'm quite sure of it.
Yeah.
And my own investigations into my ancestry kind of have proven that to me, that there's a vein of spiritually hungry people who, you know, really crave to know God and you know, so the onus falls upon us to share that you know, to channel that energy into meaningful ways to share our love of God and our love of angels and our love of Jesus and our love of things spiritual with those who maybe haven't had that experience and really, you know, to kind of give them a whet their appetites, I think is how Jesus said.
Well, I think for us in particular, we are probably put here to help people who have been turned off too by the current by some of the present representations of those things. Our job is to again restate and reinterpret and to make these things living in our day, in our current day.
Right.
And so that we can help people that are not interested in the more fossilized forms that are expressed about the Master and about angels. Because a lot of people are spiritually hungry for these things, but they get so turned off by the energy around it. And I don't blame them a bit. I do, too. So,
well, I do,
yeah.
too. I understand. Yeah. It's almost like you have to go through something really icky to get to something really beautiful. It's wrapped in this package. I think the Urantia book says, you know, if only we could resurrect Jesus from the tomb of theology. And, you know, most people wouldn't want to go into a tomb. You know what I mean? They don't want to go in there and see what's in there. And so it takes some courage to unwrap that and find the essence that's the true beauty, the kernel of truth that created that theology in the first place. But it's been buried by centuries of misunderstanding and just human inability to...
What's so interesting to me and so deeply ironic was that one of his personal missions as a human being was to free people from exactly those theological constraints and traps.
Right.
And he ended up paying the ultimate price for doing that on a human level. And his experience as a human with trying to do that is not that unusual. There are so many, many people who have paid the ultimate price in torture, imprisonment, or death for, you know, attempting to bring some living truth to the world or to challenge an orthodoxy, an existing orthodoxy, which is what he did.
And that's so true with science as well as religion.
Yeah, and it's very, very true with science. And very true with science that there are orthodoxies in science as well. Yeah.
Right. And I think it behooves us as human beings, all of us, to, you know, to do exactly, it goes back to that poem you wrote after your experience with the snobbish person in London, to thank God for our humility and our ability to realize that we don't know everything. Jesus spoke to this so many times by saying, you know, become as a little child.
Yeah.
In other words, understand that you don't know and be willing to jump off from that point of view that there is so much more than we understand and know and that God could continuously reveal himself to us if we'll only open up to those possibilities.
I also love a quote I just read. I think I just read it a day or two ago, and the Master said, he said, no display of impatience or anxiety can help you grow any faster than you're going to. Growth requires time, in other words, you know, that we have to be patient with the process of our growth and not be upset at how long it's going to take. It just takes how long it takes.
Yeah.
We really are children. We really are.
Well, yeah, and you know, that brings me back to some of what you were saying about angels and the idea that, you know, angels being mathematical prodigies and all, and you know, that beautiful vignette that you gave us of, I love the detail in it because it brings us right in, you know, somebody dying in Nova Scotia. The thing that strikes me, now those two ideas dovetail for me is this idea that, you know, as a mathematical prodigy, they would be excellent chess players.
Yeah.
They would see many, many, many moves ahead. Of course, they're not playing, you know, a board game chess, but they are trying to see all the different decision possibilities that we might be making.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at that and doing a little bit of game theory, a little bit of optimization, looking at these chess moves ahead, looking 20, 25, 30, 40, 100 moves ahead in our lives and saying, you know what, if there's a good likelihood that in about 7 years he's going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to prepare for that. So what are your own thoughts, or do you have any vignettes or anything in the works on that vein or
yes,
other veins?
I'm working right now. I'm working on a little article for the Working Angels Companion, and it's called The Gravity of the Situation.
Oh.
And that's why I've been chewing through physics again the last year. There are so many wonderful physicists. I'm not talking about metaphysics, which is something different, but real scientists who beautifully write. And the best writers are the ones who have been teachers for a long time and who have the patience to explain to non-math people what physics is attempting to explore and discover. But in The Gravity of the Situation, the story is of a man who is profoundly invisible to himself. And the angels have the work of trying to attempt to make him more visible to himself.
Wow.
And he's sitting. It's not much of a little story. He's basically just sitting there eating donuts and watching his wife's taped soap operas and musing on the characters. But as he's doing it, the lines are being pulled. The gravitational lines, the mind gravity lines, the spirit lines are being pulled by the angels to help him pull himself into view. And because sometimes the hardest person to see in life is our own self. We get so buried in the lives of other people. And that's what's happening with this character. And when we're talking about angels being like mathematical prodigies and you know, just exactly what you were talking about, Andre, I've been thinking a lot about, well, how are they trained? Are they given, like, holographic video games to kind of practice on pulling these different lines, you know, helping to focalize someone's vision over here, or helping to create an auditory field around certain words that are said so that a human mind can hear them, or helping to, how do they practice these skills so that when they're working with us in our dense state, they can actually get through to us and help us come into focus.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
you've really described their problem, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's it. And their problem, in a way, is our problem, too, because if we want to be like God, we have to approach things in the way that we imagine God approaches them. And
right.
If he does not coerce you, if he has no interest in forcing you to come to him against your will.
Right.
In other words,
yeah.
He wants you to come of your own free will. He wants you to decide to do this because you know it's the right thing to do. Not because you have been promised some magical reward, or because you've been threatened with some dire punishment. But
right.
Because you know it's about right motivation. And so everything he does is about that. and he has no interest in forcing you to do anything. But, and yet, as humans, we try to force each other and coerce each other all the time.
All the time. Yeah, we don't shy from coercion at all.
Not at all. And
no,
it gets very it gets very clever, even subliminal.
Yeah. Right.
And and we don't shy away from it, but they don't go there.
Right.
Not at all.
Yeah. Where angels wouldn't tread. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So how do they work? And in my stories I am making it maybe blatantly clear, but I, you know, it's always there is a human decision that precedes angelic action. It has to.
Yes,
a human act of decision making or desire or prayer, that because they really do, we are the ones originating the experience. That is our role in it, because we are father indwelt, and we have that that fragment, you know, of the original first cause, first source and center. And so, you know, there is no, there can be no coercion, just only support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we don't make a decision, it doesn't happen. And that's really one of the biggest, I think, conundrums for most people is, you know, how do I best get off my duff or maybe more poignantly, how do I get unstuck from where I am? You know, we've all had times in our lives where it seems like we're stuck, like we can't make a decision, or our minds tell us that it won't make any difference, or you know. So, how do you see them working around those kinds of situations where we get stuck?
I don't know. You know, that's a really good question. I don't know. I would imagine that they're stuck too. And then if we can wrap our heads, and that may be another thing that's good about helping people to muse about how angels may work, or to help them care more about angels, because maybe it will help us realize that when we're stuck, then we're sticking to others more than just ourselves. Because if they're dependent on our progression, the onus is really upon us to progress. It really is. But I don't know if there's any way to hurry past being stuck. Sometimes we're stuck for good reasons.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's an obstacle that you have to overcome, and maybe you can't even do it in this life. Maybe it's going to take the next life. And, you know, I think that there's an important point there, and that is that they'll be working with us not only in this life but in the next.
Right.
And
And we'll see them, which will be, they say that they'll be like among the first that we see.
Yeah.
Our angels. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
go, Andre. Go.
The only thing I was thinking of was that, you know, in line with the need for a decision, you know, and all the frustration that they go through and everything like that. If we just keep in mind, you know, if we have that faint flicker of faith going, even when we do feel stuck, even when a situation does seem hopeless, even when there's tremendous loss in any kind of a situation, if we just stay open and are willing to make just the tiniest decision to say, listen, I'm willing for something. And I heard that in some of your early story, you know, that there was a willingness. You weren't getting answers that you wanted in the spiritual realm. And so you said, listen, I want to believe.
And something
happened.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is where it ends up 38 years later.
This is, well, I'm thinking of, for people who are listening and they're hearing us talking about the angels being mathematical, I had written a passage that might be a nice one to read in line with that. in light of how angels work in this in these mathematical ways. And this is from an Idiot's Tale, The Lost Writings of Rapunzel, and in this book, this is the book that won in London. It won, as the British would say, for the best short story never told, which is their way of saying an unpublished short story. But in this story, Rapunzel is half human, half angel. And so she is really, really attuned to angelic presence and how the angels work. And she's gotten herself in a horrible situation, absolutely horrible. But let's see. But then she's musing on this is her muse when she's left alone for 3 days while the plot is thickening. Okay, and she's musing on how angels and humans think differently. She says, 3 days followed in almost complete solitude. Even Lily had need to keep a distance to remain within earshot of the town, for we were sorely tried by the turn of events. She'd have to warn me if they meant to storm the tower. 3 days to tally up my errors while the trees resounded with a solitary chorus of whispers, during which I felt the full weight of uncertainty regarding this latest decision. Had it been insanity to entrust the musician with my safe outcome? Was he as likely to turn in loyalty if he couldn't find profit with my family and then decide to make his money from a tale about a witch's burning? I'd have found greater comfort in my wisdom if it had not delivered me here, aloft in a tower, in isolation, and in fear for my very life. Thus I tallied all my errors and decided there was no choice but to compound them once again. If there was nobility in meaningless death, I suppose I'd go to it spotless, but sense could not be made of it, so it was necessary to wager once more on an unknowable outcome. Boredom began to impinge once the weight of conscience was done, and I started the tally of other more minor things, the stones in the floor, 882, the budding leaves on the oak below, 563, the weight of water in my cup, 4.63 ounces, numbers that come quite effortlessly to mind, but then were compromised by a combined nature. I wondered if these circumstances would be different had I full report on these numbers the way my angelic kin do, for they know not only the count of a bird's feathers, but also full tally on his flight through the air and his angle of motion as well. These numbers tumble effortlessly for them in acrobatic account, moment by moment. Though they'd never spoken in detail on their methods, I wonder if this doesn't aid them somehow in their work of aligning persons one to another and in the factoring of circumstance. Would opportunities stand out in dimension or providential coincidence occur with such frequency? For these are both the means and the evidence of their uncanny work. I've thought on it thus, that mortal man tumbles the dice, and they fly from his hand to then wrest from chance whatever number they can, this or that. Comes an angel to toss the same dice, and he knows all their sides, their flight through the air, the weight of their cubes, and the odds on their winning. Then with all of this has precision in the toss. Surely possibility must abate for him, and thus give him the greater ability at besting chance. What have I then in this strange life, for in combination I'm more than fully compromised. While in possession of heavenly knowledge, I remain rooted firmly to this world. I know a view from aloft, yet stumble on ground which others pass through effortlessly. And though versed in the methods of angels, I'm rendered impotent while they're engaged in mighty efforts. They are invisible yet effective, while I am visible to the extreme, but increasingly isolated and alone.
Oh, man. You are a great writer.
Thanks,
honey. I really love the way you write and appreciate the thoughtful contemplation you put into your words. You know, I think you capture the essence so many times.
You really are adept at revealing revelatory concepts and getting people to think, you know, and in a way we're all like the Rapunzel of your story, you know, weighted down with earthly matters.
And, yeah, and we can know better. You know, it's like there's a part of us that can know better. But you know, the precision of angelic action, I think, is definitely something worth thinking about. You know, how do they do, especially when we experience time after time such exquisite synchronicity in how events unfold in our own lives and in the cast of characters that are brought in, how perfectly these characters will, it's Jungian, how they bring up the dark self within us and put us into a situation where we must dynamically choose, because we're clearly not here simply to delight one another. You know, we drive each other crazy. And but there is an exquisite precision in how we are placed in each other's lives to do exactly that. You know, as well as to learn to love one another.
Mathematical precision, really at its best. I mean, and I think, okay, so going back to the Urantia book and some of the things it teaches about angels, that there are guardians who are over an individual, and that there are guardians who are over a group. And the groups might be bigger or smaller.
Yeah.
And I think that's all contingent upon possibilities and the subject's willingness to follow the leading, right?
Well, they say, they say actually that that circle-making decision has everything to do within the human being, the spiritual evolution and decision-making and social growth of the human being has everything to do with how the human is placed in terms of angelic guardianship.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you're denser and sort of floating out there in realms of more unconscious, then you're placed into a larger group in terms of their watch care. And then as you make more and more precise and personal decisions regarding your spiritual development, and you're placed in smaller groups until, I believe it's in the third circle of the psychic circle, when you choose that you are then given your guardian angels. And so their guardianship depends once more on human choice, you know, just how it's done. Yeah, but they must work with groups all the time, and as human beings we know that when we are that the more that we are attempting to socially harmonize and work with larger and larger groups, you can feel angelic action, I feel, you know, more directly. I don't know, that's been my experiences, you know, and I'm sure it's been yours, right?
Absolutely.
You can, yeah.
Well, and there's been certain times in my life, and Andrea, I'm sure you would attest to this as well, that I have made a decision, and it was very conscious and deliberate, and it was a decision about God. Like you, Rosie, I had a decision when I was 16 years old where I told God, I rejected a classic religion of authority because someone had told me that if what they were telling me didn't ring true within my heart, that I should reject it. And there was something about that truth that really resonated with me. And so I looked at this whole experience I was having with this religion of authority with fresh eyes. And I made a conscious decision to reject it because major things they were telling me didn't ring true. And i.e. one of the most important things was that if I didn't convert God to this, convert my parents to this religion, that God was going to kill them. And I had to come face to face with my belief and my
my own heart, whether God was a murderer or not, and whether God would murder good people just because they said they believed this or didn't believe that. And I had to reject that notion. And
I told him
right there, and it was a pivotal decision. I can go straight back to that decision, and things changed in my life. The minute I said this to God, the minute I said it, I said, God, you may be just the way they say you are. And if you are, I'm sorry. I can't worship you.
Right.
And then, as an afterthought, I told him, somehow, though, I don't think you are that way. But you're going to have to reveal yourself to me. I swear to God, every word, I remember every word I told him. I said, you're going to have to reveal yourself to me because I'm not getting involved with any other religions.
Mm.
And 4 years later, my dad died. I gave a lot of contemplation to God in those 4 years. But I didn't get involved with other religions. 4 years later, my dad died, and I told God, you have to tell me the good news now, or I'm going to lose my mind. You have to tell me the good news. And within days, the Urantia book was in my hand. And
Isn't that weird?
That's the answer to prayer. And Jesus promised that, right? He said, if you seek, you will find.
I love how these people will terrorize a child with you know, they'll take your parents hostage. I went through this. I don't know if I told you this story, but I went through the same thing as a child, because my dad was Jewish, and I ran into the Sunday school teacher, and I was a really devout little kid. I was the first one there. I sharpened pencils, you know, I was just God's little soldier in that church. And this Sunday school teacher told me that if I didn't convert my dad, that he would burn in hell because he was Jewish.
Wow.
And I think I was like 7 years old, so I went through a total panic, and it was like, how do I convince my dad that Jesus is Jewish? And so at the time, Roy Rogers was really popular, and I had a Roy Rogers school tablet, and it said, Roy Rogers, King of the Cowboys. And my dad had been a cowboy. So I thought, Roy Roger, King of the Cowboys. And then I found another picture that said, Jesus, King of the Jews. So I went to my dad, and I said, Dad, I pulled out the Roy Rogers one. I said, Dad, here's Roy Rogers. I said, you were a cowboy, right? And he said, right. And I pulled out the Roy Rogers thing. I said, Dad, this says that Roy Rogers, you're king. Right? and he goes, okay. And I thought I was making headway with him because he agreed to it, and even if he was laughing. And so then I said, Dad, you're Jewish, right? And he said, yeah. And I pulled out my other picture, and I said, it says here that Jesus is your king. and he said, well, we don't believe that the Messiah has come yet, honey. And I remember being so crushed, and it was like, oh, now God's going to kill him, you know. And then I remember going to church and having exactly that experience. I was like, if God really is going to burn my dad, then I just can't believe in him. I can't, you know, then I don't like him. Then I had to make a choice between my human father and my heavenly father, and I chose my human father. And it was actually a fissure that went on for years. You know, it went on for years. And I don't know, it's just odd to me that Sunday school teachers and priests or whoever these people are would put a child in that position with just not even thinking about it. Happens all the time.
It happens all the time.
Yeah.
And they're well-meaning, but goodness gracious, it's so thoughtless, and it's only justified because people rationalize in their mind that they're dealing with eternal life and death, and therefore, you know, anything goes. and forget about psychology of a child or anything like that. Father Thomas Keating has made the statement, you know, people have no business talking to five-year-olds about hell. There's
right.
no business bringing up a concept like
whatever.
That, you know, or to children at all. There's no way that a child can comprehend any notion of that. And so whether you believe in that or not, and, of course, as Urantians, we don't, you know, it's just ridiculous what people will do with children if they only understood a God that really treats us all as children. And that wasn't harsh with us, maybe we would you know, be that way with our children a little bit more.
Yeah,
well, this
well,
calls
hopefully.
For a quote.
Yeah.
This calls for a quote from the Urantia book, because what you guys have just been talking about, your conversation, Rosie, with your father, and reminded me of a conversation that Jesus had with his father when he was 13, and they were in Jerusalem for Jesus' first Passover. And this gives our listeners a flavor of the Urantia book and young Jesus, which, of course, to me, the story of Jesus in the Urantia book, his entire life, is just unsurpassed. But this just
Beautiful.
Says it so poignantly. It's from Jesus at Jerusalem, paper 125. Though many of the temple rituals very touchingly impressed Jesus' sense of the beautiful and the symbolic, he was always disappointed by the explanation of the real meanings of these ceremonies, which his parents would offer in answer to his many searching inquiries. Jesus simply would not accept explanations of worship and religious devotion which involve belief in the wrath of God or the anger of the Almighty. In further discussion of these questions, after the conclusion of the temple visit, when his father became mildly insistent that he acknowledge acceptance of the Orthodox Jewish beliefs, Jesus turned suddenly upon his parents and, looking appealingly into the eyes of his father, said, "My father, it cannot be true. The Father in heaven cannot so regard his erring children on earth. The heavenly Father cannot love his children less than you love me. And I well know, no matter what unwise thing I might do, you would never pour out wrath upon me, nor vent anger against me. If you, my earthly father, possess such human reflections of the divine, how much more must the heavenly Father be filled with goodness and overflowing with mercy? I refuse to believe that my Father in heaven loves me less than my Father on earth."
Beautiful.
Yeah,
so
that's
beautiful.
13-year-old Jesus.
Yeah, that would be 13-year-old Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
But most 13-year-olds probably would put it differently.
Yeah, that's true.
Isn't that beautiful, though? That's so exquisite.
Yeah,
beautiful.
It says it all,
yeah.
Really. Yeah.
It
can
says
we all,
it all.
Just
yeah.
refuse to any longer believe these terrible things about God?
Well,
can we just refuse?
It makes it really hard. I mean, for me, it's made it so hard as a Urantian to have to listen to people pouring the wrath of God down in the name of Jesus. It's like,
right.
You guys just, you know, what would happen if he were to come to you as he actually is? You know, how would you square any of that with the spirit of the Master that we come to know? Through the teachings, and then as he becomes reflected through our own experience, we just know that being is not remotely like that and is so misrepresented by that kind of theology. And but how beautiful, sis, that's beautiful.
Yeah. It says it all, really, and it's about, and I know you feel the same way, and Andre, we all agree that if we could just share the God we know because of the Urantia book, and you know, my hat's off to you, Rosie, because you are doing that. You went to work in the art department,
mm-hmm.
and you started to use your incredible gifts
to share these truths in new and creative ways.
You know,
to me, you're doing it. And when you say you're going to, you know, you're going to do this book about Jesus and then the one about angels, it thrills me. I can't wait.
Good. I'm
well,
trying
to
get them
back on.
I'm trying. Well, I would love to be, and I'm trying to get them switched over to another publishing engine so that that bookstores can order these easily, and the price points break along the lines of what will work, and we can get them out internationally. Because I really feel that the work of Urantia and authors, artists, musicians, dramatists, the role of the creative artist in spirituality has always been very, very important. We always help people to visualize spirit. That's our job. And
right.
So if we can do it when we're given such riches in this revelation, and there will be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of us doing it, and eventually these things will filter down and help people into enlarged concepts, whether they are lucky enough to run into the actual Urantia book or not, you know, because
right.
it is a process of revelation. It really is. I mean, the book
right.
itself is a process of revelation. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
without a doubt.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
And is there any, do you have a website, Rosie, where people where they could see your art? I mean, they may not understand that you fully illustrate books yourself, and I would love to hear from you a little bit of your art background and the method you use to do these illustrations, because they just have such a whimsical feeling to me, such a kind of a lore, a fairy tale kind of Celtic feeling.
Well, my website got hacked, and so my son and I are working to get the website back in order, and we put it on a more secure platform. But the website URL is www.moonlogic.com. So it's moonlogic, just like the man in the moon, moonlogic.com. And I do have a Facebook page that people can go on to. It's if you go on Facebook and you search for Moonlogic Press, then you'll be connected to my page, Moonlogic Press.
I put it up there once. I'll put it up there again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andre.
Yeah.
You bet.
And also go to Amazon.com and search R.E. Liskey. Spelled L-I-E-S-K-E.
Yeah.
Yeah. I put that up on our chat board as well.
Okay,
oh, good.
Great.
Thank you. Yeah.
And all of Rosie's books will come up.
They'll come up, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the process that I've been a printmaker for many years. I work in, I utilize a process called copperplate etching. And so, and what it is, it involves actually drawing the image onto a metal plate. So it's just like drawing on paper, only it's devilishly hard to erase anything. Because once you get it engraved in a plate, you have to do all these processes. It's very labor intensive, and but the images, to me, when you put the metal plate, ink up the metal plate, put it onto a press bed, put moistened paper over it, and pull it through that press, the image has such a deep appeal and authority to it, and it kind of, to me, it symbolically speaks to an older time in printing, when all printing was done that way.
Yeah, that's
and,
why.
And I think it's important. This is an interesting little piece for me in terms of how I want to approach this psychologically, because I like the idea of putting these revelatory concepts into a format that somehow evokes an older time. So, and that's one of the reasons that I like to use the storybook format, because there's, if you're looking at a storybook as an adult, you can feel that this storybook has been with you since you were a child, and that it somehow helps to place the concept into an older feeling, just an older feeling place, a place that is more evocative of childhood, so that we feel like these concepts have been with us all along, which they have been, but we are, that some of them are radical restatements of things that have come through other revelations. So, you know, it's my way of kind of softening the blow.
Well, and it's effective. You know, I'm so glad you articulated that, because you really described what I feel when I look at that. It evokes many things for me. It does evoke childhood and a sense of, you know, whimsy. I think I've called it whimsy, and you know, that's what it evokes for me, a whimsical feeling. And I love the idea of using parables or stories, the storybook approach to telling these, because I think, you know, we need that. We need someone to help us interpret.
It's odd to me that that storybooks have been abandoned for grown-ups, because we need them more as grown-ups than we probably did as children. The comfort of a smaller book with big pictures, you know, and also the feeling of holding the storybook and turning the pages and just having it unwind in your child's heart, so close to when you go to sleep, you know.
And, there you go.
Yeah.
To simplify it, to bring it down to its essence, which for me, you know, great philosophical works of literature are wonderful and important. You know, I just read a book called Hobbit Lessons from a fellow who specializes in C.S. Lewis and Tolkien's works, and he boils it down to the essence of the lessons that were given in the story of the Hobbit. And it's really beautiful. It's wonderful just to boil it down to that. But sometimes, for me, I read a lot of poetry, and poetry can say in a few stanzas what an author might take a whole book to communicate.
Right, yeah.
The
essence
of a deep and profound spiritual lesson, you know, that's that has great import. And so, you know, I appreciate both.
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, the reason, you know, that fairy tales are so interesting, because we see them done again and again and again. You know, how many versions of Rapunzel have been done since I was a little girl? And they're done again and again. But it's because there are universal themes present in those stories, like like in The Hobbit and The Fellowship of the Rings and those wonderful stories, that speak to us, speak to our human condition. They speak to it all the way from childhood until we turn back into dust. And they have tremendous power, because they reoccur in our experience again and again and again. There are monstrous forces. There are, you know, deep challenges that we have to go through. And there are beauteous wonders. There really are these things, and this is what these tales really speak to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's archetypical, really.
It's it is. It is. Yeah.
So I'm curious as to what you've learned, you know, from some of the papers on art as well, and how that informs what you do, Rosie. Because I love your art. There's definitely spirit and personality in your art. It really draws me in. I feel like little Andre loves your calendar.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so glad.
I just love those pictures. It just makes me feel like a little boy again.
Exquisite.
But when I look at some of what the papers talk about in the Celestial Artisans papers, I mean, it's clear that, among other things, you're a color worker, that you delight in the same thing that the color workers do, those artists of light and shade. You might call sketchers and painters mm-hmm. artists who preserve passing scenes and transient episodes for future Marantxa enjoyment. Well, they're talking about the next life there, but, you know, the Marantxa soul begins in this life.
Exactly.
And all true art, as you said, I mean, I can't capture it exactly the way you said it, but, you know, you said it almost, they have an obligation to portray spirit. Do you want to expand on that at all?
The way that the papers on the Celestial Artisans in the Arantxa book have affected me is to give me a much more long-term view and a much greater sense of responsibility to being an artist. And let's see, how can I explain this? It's become such a deep part of my psychology that I actually have a hard time locating it as we're talking mm-hmm. about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the feeling that you sign up, or the teaching where they say you sign up for your first 1,000 years as a Celestial Artisan. That alone radically altered my perspective of what it was to do what I did. It's like, wow, they really take that seriously in spirit, don't they? And they go into the fact that our senses will be expanded, just the next level of progression, our senses will be expanded sevenfold, and then we will be rekeyed upwards of, what's the number, says it's 588 times we're rekeyed, and so at each point we will be experiencing an amplification in terms of our own ability to perceive color, sound, smell, all of this. These our senses will be amplified. And these teachings inform me every day when I go out to my studio. They really do. It's like I want to hit the ground running in spirit. I want to have the best body of work that I can possibly produce on this level so that I can be placed into a more advanced group than I would be had I not known about the teaching, okay, on the Marantxa level, and really have a body of work that where I can point to it and I can say, look, these are my talents, and this is what I've done with them so far. And I've worked to the best of my ability. I take it seriously. I'm ready for your teachers and your trainers, and I want to be placed in the right place. And, you know, if when our celestial overseers know that we're serious, they can work so much better with us than if we're just sort of sitting on our talent, or, well, you know, I really went through a tremendous conflict with this in my adult life, because there were years in my adult life where I just didn't feel that being an artist was a serious enough thing to do as a grown-up. It was like, well, surely I must have other talents that must be more important than this. But at some point in my adult life, and it was about 10 years ago, when I kept being put into situation after situation that was actually conducive to doing art, and feeling my angels twiddling their thumbs. I was in one project where it was such a time-wasting thing, and I literally felt my angels were sitting there twiddling their thumbs and saying, you're not serious, are you? Are you seriously going to waste our time with this, or are you going to get to work?
Wow.
And you know, so that's how this stuff has impacted me. It impacts me on all levels. And it's I don't know if I've effectively described it, but
well, I think you have in a lot of ways. How do you suggest then to people, and there may be listeners out there who are in that same position that you were in once, where you really weren't sure that this was what you were supposed to be doing, and at some point you did make a decision to move forward, and obviously it's worked for you. You've been able to move forward, even if you know your career as the snooty guy was pointing out it didn't measure up to the snooty guy, you know, and what careers should look like on the outside. You know, what should it look like on the inside? What did it feel like to make that decision, and how might you?
I think what it felt like was an inevitability. It was that, and this is something that everybody, all individuals, have to come to grips with in terms of their gifts, and it really is about the parable of the talents, isn't it? You know, when you're given talent, you know, you have an obligation to work with that talent, and you can run from it, and you can be lazy about it, or you can attempt to move into other fields. Somehow, angels have a way, and you know, under the direction of spirit, to lead us back into the direction that we need to be in. So you get your signs and signals from the outside too. But it is coming to grips with one's talents, wherever your talents are. If you have a talent, it is important to look at it and take it seriously. They're there for a reason. The Urantia book tells us that these gifts that we're given artistically, spiritually, scientifically, however they're playing out, are not given to us lightly. They're really not. That they have to have, there has to be some sort of genetic background for it, that they're really given to us in a serious way. And reckoning with that within is a serious matter.
Yeah. that is a serious matter, and I think your story exemplifies just exactly how you came to certain decision points, and for different aspects of your life. One was with the revelation, and seeing that that's what it was, and you know, finding it the way that you did by being open to it, by questioning. The other aspect is this business of talent, and I think that's a whole other order of where things go. You know, I'll share publicly that I feel like at times, you know, I haven't been fully living up to mine, and you know, I've found a lot of ways into doing something. You know, I don't know that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I feel like that man that was invisible to himself that you talked about sometimes. So it's interesting how these things work out, and what you're led to in life. And I'm grateful enough to be led to the Urantia book. But it is another. It's like another level, isn't it?
Well, I think also sometimes. For us as humans, it's what we are running away from that can give us a cue too. Because because I've run many times in my life, I've run away from my art and gone, oh God, I don't want to do this. This is a sucky gig. I don't want to do this. I can surely do something where I'll get more financial reward, more adult recognition, and have a business card that makes sense. And and then by virtue of running away from it, you realize, well, it's obviously an important enough thing to run away from. You know what I mean? It kind of almost becomes defined by your resistance to it. And a lot of times the things that we run away from are the things that we end up running smack into, because it's we're resisting them so hard that they gain shape and size and scope by virtue of our own resistance. And art's a tough one. For artists, it's very hard because our society is willing to give lip service to supporting art, but there's very little support for artists. And you can find yourself really feeling alone in a studio or alone in a workroom. And that's something that's very, very important for artists who may be listening. If you are feeling alone in a workroom or in a studio, it's really important to reach out to art support groups that are online.
There you go.
And to find other artists that are having the same problem that you are, because it can be a very solitary field. It can feel like a solitary field. And what artists have to remember is this, that an artist actually needs to use their creative ability to create creative community. You need to create your own business and creative community when you're an artist. And you'll be surprised how many other artists are longing for that connection as well, and that does help to support you emotionally and psychologically as you're attempting to do art.
I just found something on meetup.com that I've posted to the chat room. Artistsupportgroup.meetup.com apparently has a few of them there, but I'm sure there are others under other names.
And with Meetup, you can go on Meetup actually and start one yourself, and there are many more avenues now for artists to create community than there were before the advent of the computer. So it's better now than it was before. How many times have I described working in the art department? Because for years I was doing outreach work in Latin America, right? And that was very people intense. And I remember when I made the decision to do art and to do outreach through my art, I told Sis, I said, I've been moved to the art department, and it's in the basement of where you all are working, with just like a bare light bulb over my desk. and I'm all alone. It was like, that's what it felt like. It was so funny.
Well, you know, and we're coming down to the end of our show, which makes me sad because I've just so enjoyed this show. Rosie, it's been so much fun to interview you.
We talked for hours.
You know,
right.
We could. And we have.
We have.
And we have. But, you know, and what you say about artists is true of spiritualists, too. I mean, and of, you know, the people who want to share their hearts spiritually, oftentimes that can be a very lonely place, too. And you also have to seek like minds and like hearts to stay inspired, to stay willing, because you do run into those obstacles and you do run into ridicule and misunderstanding. I mean, it just goes with the territory. And
of course,
ridicule. Jesus, of course, was ridiculed. So if he was ridiculed and if he was misunderstood, we have to appreciate that we'll be misunderstood too.
I love what he says when he goes. He says, "If you follow me, it's the sure path to trouble." Remember when he said that?
It's the sure path to trouble. But he said, "I can't promise to deliver you from trouble. But what I can promise is that I will go with you through all of it."
Right. And, I'll go with you through all of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I love that. Exactly. What a promise.
Yeah.
And we know because we love him so much, you know, that feels good to know that he's with us through all of it. And and thank you for your art. Thank you for your indelible spirit and your willingness to keep persevering with these projects and bringing them to, you know, completion. And, you know, we would like to stay tuned with you. And please, you know, anytime you want to come on the show and announce when you're done with a new project, Love to hear about it. Love to hear where
Good.
We can find it.
Love that.
And
Great.
I will tell people, please please check back with Moon Logic. Is that it?
It's Moon Logic Press, and since I've been working to get these things over to Lightning Source so that I can get them in your catalog, but Lightning Source is not lightning fast in getting back to me. So,
Moon Logic.com.
Moonlogic.com and Amazon.com. Okay. All right. Thank you so much, you guys. I love you so much. And
I've loved
all the years that we have spent together, you know.
Here's to millennia more.
yes. Our first thousand years.
To the first thousand years. There we go.
All right. Okay.
God bless you,
I love you guys. Okay.
Love you,
love you too. It was a real joy, Rosie.
Thank you, Andre. Love you. Bye.
And next week we're going to be talking about the inhabited worlds with our old friend Don Ware. So that should be fun and interesting. So until then, we'll just say bye for now.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andre.
Thank you. It was a good show.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.